We have thrown the same number of innings as Clayton Kershaw this year. Why don't we get a book, Jordan?
It should be that simple. No, we did not write a book about Clayton Kershaw, but Andy McCullough did, and he joins this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbecast to talk all about it. I saw Paul Skeens in person. I'm going to talk about that too. And Jake, Mike Trout needs surgery on this episode of Baseball Barbecast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks that Clayton Kershaw should have just been a reliever all along. I am Jake Mintz. That is Jordan Schusterman. And he would have gotten those outs in relief if he had just always been doing that.
What a loogie he would have been. It is Wednesday. Good morning, my dear friend Jake Mintz. On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we're going to talk a lot about Clayton Kershaw, who, yeah, we haven't seen him pitch this year, but hopefully we will later this year. Our good friend Andy McCullough wrote a book about Clayton Kershaw, which you can pre-order and is fantastic. And Clayton Kershaw is one of the most fascinating players and kind of characters of his generation. And so we're going to have a nice long chat about writing a book about Clayton Kershaw with Andy. That'll be the bulk of this show. But before that, we're going to talk about another pitcher who is very much pitching, although not as much as people would like. And that is Paul Skeens, who I saw last night.
Or where they want him to pitch.
Or where they wanted to pitch. Who last night was pitching in AAA in Indianapolis, and I was there to see it. And I'm going to talk all about that. And at the end of the show, we're going to talk about Mike Trout. Here's the thing, folks. Our chat with Andy was longer than expected. It was fantastic. We want to leave it all in. So much happened in baseball yesterday. Because I was at the Skeens game and because I was so lucky on that, I watched zero Major League Baseball last night. And I got home and I was scrolling through the app. I was like, oh my God, there was a lot that happened. Oh, I missed all kinds of stuff. And so I feel bad not talking about that, but I don't want to because I didn't actually watch it. I want to get settled. So we'll cover some of this stuff on Friday.
And I was driving from Baltimore back to New York last night. And so I only just had it on the radio. Mm-hmm. But like Johan Rojas go ahead, ninth inning home run. We had the B situation. We, you know, the Rays fought the Brewers and the Astros sent Abreu down. All of that, take that, put that in your back pocket, and we will get to it on Friday. Jordan, Paul Skeens. Paul Skeens, who is Paul Skeens? Paul Skeens was drafted number one overall last year after throwing out like the greatest college pitching season ever. Drafted by the Pirates, they had him throw like very little last year. There was talk about him being on the team out of camp this year, the big league team. That did not happen. He is now in AAA for the Indianapolis Indians, absolutely shoving and carving for them. And you, as an Indiana resident, went out and saw the show in person last night. And let me just say, before we get into that, I just received a text that I would like to read from an unnamed individual, okay, about Paul Skeens, unprompted.
Okay, I'm ready. Yes.
He says, "Hey, Mr. Owner. We have the greatest pitching prospect since Roger Clemens. Awesome. When is he starting? Opening day. Great. This place is going to be buzzing. Oh, no, not here. Oh, in Indianapolis? Indianapolis? Why would we do that? We would do that to save money. To save money? If he's Roger Clemens, won't he make us a ton of money? Yeah, but 6 years from now, we still control him. 6 years from now, he will have had TJ and be begging for a trade to the Yankees or the Dodgers. I want the kid in Pittsburgh tomorrow or you're all fired. Thanks. Have a great day. Yes, sir, boss. Some things are so stupid, only smart people believe them." So that's where we're at.
Yeah, I think, and I will have a longer piece coming out at Yahoo about this situation. And I am going to be probably a little bit more harsh on here than I will in the piece, just because what I really focused on is trying to understand it and just looking at it from the Pirates' perspective, not, you know, parroting the talking points, but like, what? Let's, before we just get angry, what is this about, right? Why is Paul Skeens still in AAA? So we start with the service time discussions, right? Well, first of all, people like, if who haven't been following this closely, why are people so upset about him? Because, okay, you see him throw a couple awesome innings in spring training. Okay, that's fine. He had thrown five professional innings at that point or six professional innings. Okay, let's see him prove it in AAA. Through six starts, Paul Skeens has struck out 41 batters in 23 innings. He's allowed 14 hits. He has walked six. He has allowed one run. Watching him last night, he threw six innings for the first time this year, and he was just absurd. Now, AAA batters, AAA lineups are littered with just a bizarre collection of occasional top 100 prospects and, you know, fringe big leaguers or veterans trying to hang on. It's not the major leagues. It's not the major leagues, right? Obviously. And so, you know, these numbers are impressive because when you watch him, it is very impressive, but the numbers are the numbers. However, he's proven, yes, he can be a good pitcher in AAA. Amazing. I think we know that by now. So why is he still there, right? Let's talk about the service time element. Had the Pirates, because with the new CBA, the league did not want teams to keep doing, you know, service time manipulation, which for those of you who don't know, if you wait long enough into a season to call a player up, that means you retain an extra year of control on top, you know, at the end of their, you know, pre-free agency contract. If you put him on the roster on opening day and he is immediately gets a full year of service time, now you lose that extra year, which in this case we're talking about 2020, 2030 or whatever. Okay, but the point is, what did they do in the CBA to change that or incentivize against that? They said, hey, if you put a player on your opening day roster and he's a top prospect and he wins Rookie of the Year, you get a draft pick.
Great.
He gets the year of service, but you get a draft pick. It's a good deal, right?
Good deal.
I mean, the Mariners got this with Julio. The D-backs and Orioles going to have this with Gunnar and Corbin Carroll. They got first-round draft picks. That's a huge deal. Okay, that's nice. The Pirates decided we're not going to do that. We're going to keep him in the minor leagues. And it seems that the goal here, from the Pirates' perspective, yes, perhaps it is to keep the extra year. But at this point, I don't think it's going to matter because Paul Skenes could still come up and win Rookie of the Year. If he wins Rookie of the Year, he can get a full year of service by doing that. But the Pirates would not, again, they're not going to get a draft pick because he wasn't in the opening day roster. So then what is the point? It seems that what they care about is very much the workload. And essentially, they look at Paul Skenes, who pitched 122 innings last year for LSU, all before the end of June. And they've decided, rather than have him go full blow and at his best in April and May, we would rather bring him along super slowly after his workload last year and have him peaking and pitching deep into games in the second half of the season. Looking at previous cases that we have with Strasburg and other pitchers we've seen even more recently, where they come up and then at the end of the year, we're managing the innings down the stretch. We say, we can't do this. We'd rather have him at his best and not coming up on an artificial cap in the second half of the season.
We're all going to die. Okay.
Oh, okay. That's
we're all going to die. Yep. And, eventually, but like, elbows and shoulders explode. And the here and the now is so undervalued. It is so undervalued because for all we know, he could slip on a banana peel tomorrow. He could blow out anyway. And I am of the opinion, I have gotten to this kind of cynical point when it comes to pitcher injuries. We don't know Jack. And so we know that you shouldn't throw 200 pitches in the cold. Right. Like we know some stuff, but like in my mind, I understand that they're being careful. Paul Skenes last year was doing horse behavior. He was a beast for LSU. He was shouldering a lot of the load, like you said, 122 innings before July ended. And so like, in my mind, I'm like, just call him up, let him throw. If you need to IL him or like have him skip a start, that's fine. But this is not a little rinky dink pitcher. Like, no, if anybody can handle this, Paul Skenes is 6'7", 240. Yes. Like he's a
he
beast.
Is large. Yes, but this is where the logic is flawed, right? Because clearly, because of where we're at with pitcher injuries, there's some element of caution from that perspective. We don't want to work him too hard. We're so scared he's going to get hurt. Blah 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 blah. We just want to keep it as easy as possible at this stage in his career and after what he did last year. That's fine. But the other logic of we want him at his best down the stretch. For a Pirates team that has just fallen, like in theory, okay, great. Oh, the Pirates are in it. Oh, they're 9-2. Oh, all right, great. We do want Paul Skenes at his best because we're competing for something in the second half. Maybe that still ends out to be true. But at this stage, it's like, great, we're saving him for his best for when it's not going to matter. Whereas the Pirates, they need a hit. And Paul Skenes, while he could hit in college, is not going to help the offense right now. To your point in the text you read earlier, like, the goal and what all we care about is the major league teams trying to win. And Paul Skenes would be giving the Pirates the best chance to win baseball games right now. That is a fact. That's a fact. I am as understanding and like patient with this stuff as anyone, probably too far in the team's perspective in a lot of these situations. what I watched last night, it's like he's a major league pitcher. So he's not going to put up a 0.39 ERA in the big leagues, but he's one of your best pitchers. Maybe that was true a month ago. Maybe it wasn't. What he's shown you so far now is that that is the case. And so that is the disconnect here, is you are trying to save him for an end of a season that might end up not being as important as you think. And at this point, the service time thing is the service time thing, because he's going to have to come up here in the next couple of weeks and it's going to not end up mattering. And maybe he wins rookie of the year and maybe it doesn't matter. Super two is a whole other thing in terms of getting a fourth year of arbitration versus a third year of arbitration. When you're the Pirates, you're worried about all these little things. We're past it. He's going to come up. He's going to be up in the big leagues in the next couple of weeks. And it's unfortunate that this is how it started, but that is my understanding as to why we got here.
The Pirates have not earned the benefit of the doubt.
Correct. No,
I okay. And so like, if this was an organization, say the Mariners or the Dodgers or the Guardians, or team that is like considered to be elite with pitching development, right, and has taken good care. I understand that every team has had pitcher injuries and Walker Buehler and just, I get that. But I'm saying is the Pirates do not have a track record of winning baseball, of like getting the team to a point where they're good. And so like, I do not, unfortunately, like trust the way that they've handled Skeens, because they've not shown that they can do that. Now, maybe Jared Jones is like, I understand that he's been good. I don't know. That whole thing does bum me out, and I remain skeptical, and I hope that I'm wrong, and I hope that the Pirates win the World Series and all of this stuff, and I hope Skeens turns out to be the right thing, and I hope he never gets injured, right? I hope all those things, okay? But,
yeah.
Jordan, you were in attendance last night to watch Paul Skeens do the thing that he does professionally, which is throw baseballs. How was that?
Yeah, man. So he's the hardest throwing starting pitcher in the world right now. He's, you know, sitting 99. But what was so impressive was he's clearly working on other things. And he knows, all right, I got 100 if I need it. But this pitch that he's throwing at 94 to 96, which is essentially, he's calling it a sinker. Statcast is calling it a splitter. The grip is something in between. Whatever it is ridiculous. And the only other pitcher who throws it is Yoan Duran. Is the only comparison is Twins closer Yoan Duran, and he's a closer. And Paul Skeens can kind of whip this out and throw it when he wants over the course of six innings, which had these poor Buffalo hitters in a bad place, physically and mentally, I would say. And that was the pitch that really stood out. And of course, you know, the sliders, you know, high 80s and sharp, and that did what he needed to do. But the command was there. You know, the one walk was just kind of a slider that kind of backed up on him, got away from him. But it all looked apart. Just the mound presence and just his he's gigantic, and like it's a lower slot, and in an interesting way, he's so big. But like from where he's releasing, he's, you know, getting pretty decent extension. Everything about it is, it's, you know, you already feel like you've lost when you step in, right? And it's not, listen, these are good hitters, even in AAA, but a lot of them look truly overmatched. And that won't necessarily be the case in the big leagues, but it will be for some. It will be for some when we're talking about this stuff. And I think what makes me most encouraged about his future is he hasn't been challenged yet. But when you talk to his teammates and you talk to him, he is ready to make those adjustments and excited to make those adjustments. And that's something that Brent Honeywell, you know, friend of the show, who closed out the win last night with a perfect, you know, 11th inning. He was awesome. And Brent, who's, you know, had experience as a top pitching prospect. But what Brent said, what I really appreciated, he said was, I can't wait for Paul Skeens to have to pitch. Right. Cause so far he's getting up there, and not that he's not pitching, but he's chucking it by. And that's what he did for a lot of at LSU, right? Even in the SEC, he could just overwhelm people, and he's still doing that in AAA. And that's not going to always be true. But while we talk about it as the concern, oh, what's going to happen when he faces some adversity? Oh, what's going to happen when he faces big leagues? Like, no, that's the fun part. That's what Paul Skeens is looking forward to. That's what we should all be looking forward to. Not as a, oh no, what's going to happen? Like, yeah, he's going to get rocked in the big leagues at some point, and he's going to figure it out, because this dude has gotten so much better so fast. He was a two-way player at Air Force 2 years ago. Now he's one of the best pitching prospects we've ever seen. he is tremendous. And it was so fun to watch, and I'm excited to see him in Pittsburgh here soon.
You know who knows how good Paul Skeens is? Paul Skeens. And that is the element of it that I take, is Paul Skeens has the it factor, the wow factor, the scariness that all of these legendary pitchers have, where you have lost before you step in the box. He is intimidating because his confidence level is outrageous. And why wouldn't it be? Because he's throwing 100. And so that is just reinforcing itself. And he is the type of player who I just believe will do the things he needs to do to get himself to get outs.
Yes. And the last note I will say on this before we send it to Andy is, as we know, we don't know how hard it's going to be when he goes to the big leagues. There will be some adjustments that he has to make. Listen, pitching development is perilous no matter what organization you are in. Look no further than the guy he was facing last night, Alek Manoah, who 2 years ago was one of the best pitchers in baseball, and now he's back in AAA for some reason. As I'll steal this line from Sam Blum, who texted me this. Two pitchers who should not be in AAA for very different reasons. Alek Manoah versus Paul Skeens. But I will say, Alek Manoah looked awesome. I'll leave it there because I don't want to promise anything. Alek Manoah looked awesome. I will say that. Good for Alek Manoah. However, it is a reminder, as is many a cautionary tale. I think what happened to Jackson Holliday, I know that's a hitter, it's different, he's younger, whatever. Mike Elias commenting recently that the gap between AAA and the big leagues is bigger than ever. That is true for everybody, whether you're a hitter or a pitcher. And we will see Paul Skeens make that adjustment soon. So I'm excited. I think it's going to happen soon. I think he's going to have one more start. I don't know this for sure. The other part of this is they're trying to get him on a five-man rotation where he's getting regular MLB rest. That's also not something that he's done, of course, when he was in college or even in the early start of the AAA season. So that's another thing that they're working him towards in addition to just the pitch count. And I think he's going to be on that schedule pretty close here soon. So Pirates have a 9-game homestand coming up starting on Friday. And I do believe we will see him at some point during that homestand. So we'll see.
Will I meet you there? Meet you in Pittsburgh? You want to go do that?
Probably not, but I will be seeing them at some point soon. I don't think in this first time. So,
anyway. I will do everything I can to get to that debut. That's going to be sick.
Yeah, if you can't, man. Jordan Schusman. We'll see. Again, this is not like sourced or anything. This is just based on the workload buildup and based on the schedule. That is my best guess. But because at this point, yeah, if they hold on to this until June, it's a farce. It is a farce. I will say that full throated. It is a farce if that is the case. If he is still
speaking of farces, Andy McCullough's book is a tote. No, I'm kidding. We are going to now cut to our interview that we did with Andy McCullough, who wrote the Clayton Kershaw biography that is due. I believe it's out later next week. I have already read it because we were built like that. We got an early copy. It is delightful. It is lovely. I have so much respect and admiration for Andy as a writer. I have learned more from him than anybody else about writing in the last year. And the book is a triumph, and you should all buy it. And here is our conversation with Andy. And we are back here on Baseball Barbiecast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman with a very special guest, Andy McCullough of The Athletic. But for the next 25 minutes, Andy, you are not of The Athletic. You are the author of The Last of His Kind, Clayton Kershaw, and The Burden of Greatness, available wherever you get your books. Please pre-order the book. It is phenomenal. It is fantastic. It is undoubtedly the definitive biography on one Mr. Clayton Kershaw. Andy, good morning. How are you doing?
Hey guys, how are you? Thank you very much for having me.
I'm excited to talk about Clayton Kershaw. I guess let's go to the beginning. Not the beginning of Clayton Kershaw, the beginning for Andy and Clayton Kershaw. Can you establish your credentials? Why did you write this book? Why are you the person to do this?
That's a very aggressive question, Jordan. Thank you. I think the book speaks for itself. No, I mean, so I had covered the Dodgers for several years. I was the beat writer at the Los Angeles Times. And then since moving to The Athletic, I live in New York now, but I still write a decent amount about the Dodgers. And, covering the Dodgers in kind of the time period that I did, the primary assignment I felt was, you know, covering Clayton Kershaw. And so wrote a ton about him during that time, had continued to write about him in the subsequent years. And, you know, I'd been trying to sort of latch on to a book project of something that I've always really wanted to do. And during the 2021 playoffs, when Kershaw was injured and not really able to pitch, we had a few conversations where he sounded just like a bit more reflective than he had been in previous years. He's a pretty like guarded sort of guy. He's not big on, you know, looking back, looking forward. He's very sort of regimented and blinkered in some ways. But I got the sense that he, you know, had an understanding of like kind of where his career was at, and like it was just seemed that he was going to be a little bit more open. And so, you know, fast forward to May of 2022, you know, I approached him, flew out to LA, and said that I would like to write a book about him. That, you know, I thought his story was really, really interesting. I thought there's, you know, from a writing perspective, there's a very clear narrative arc of him just kind of in this, you know, 7-year quest to win a title. And I told him that, you know, the book, I was going to write it either way, but the book would be better if he participated. And he kind of laughed. He was like, oh, geez, you know, but, you know, he agreed pretty easily. There wasn't like a long negotiation. It was like a 5-10 minute conversation. You know, he said he would check with his wife, Ellen, but that it probably would be just fine. And, you know, yeah, we talked in that May, made plans to meet up in the winter of 2022. I spent, you know, a decent amount of time in Texas with him that winter, and then met up with him on several occasions, you know, during 2023, in addition to all the other reporting that, you know, that went into the book. But yeah, I mean, I felt like, you know, spending time around him with the Dodgers, I had an understanding for, you know, what made him, you know, sort of the Hall of Fame pitcher he's going to be. But I think in doing this was able to unlock some stuff that, you know, I was happy to sort of get on the page.
So the whole book kind of revolves around the idea of the fifth day, right? The normal pitching cycle for a starting pitcher throws every 5 days, and the days in between those days are very different than the start days. Kershaw has like created this fear that I have of like interacting with any starter on their start day. And I don't know if you too feel that, like if you're in a locker room and like the starting pitcher walks in, it's like, because of Clayton Kershaw's reputation, I'm horrified to interact with like Clark Schmidt now. what is it about that cycle that was alluring to you that felt right to kind of revolve the book around it?
Yeah. Well, I think that, like it's pretty common, right? For example, from a media perspective, like the starting pitcher is not available to talk, right? The day before, you know, before his start, like in the pregame situation. There are some pitchers who kind of didn't care about that. Like CC Sabathia on occasion would talk, and R.A. Dickey on occasion would talk. But, for the most part, you kind of leave that person alone. But Kershaw, even within that sort of culture, stood apart just in talking to his teammates. They would tell you that when they walked into the clubhouse, if they hadn't checked the schedule, they could tell it was his day just based on the environment inside the room. And some of that is his own behavior. You know, he's bouncing a ball in his left hand, basically, you know, in the hours from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. He's throwing curveballs against the wall. He's sort of pacing through the hallways. He's wearing this, this huge, you know, Dodgers jacket zipped up all the way to his neck, wearing cleats at 1 p.m. like a lunatic, you know, that sort of thing. And it's something that teammates just always talk about. You ask them like, what was it like playing with Kershaw? And they'll be like, oh my God, dude, he was so intense on the day of the starts, right? And so I thought it was really interesting to just ask him like, dude, what are you doing? Like kind of where does that come from? And he was, you know, it was something that we connected really early, like in talking. He was like, oh, it goes back to, you know, being in high school and feeling this sort of intense pressure to like provide for, you know, for my mom, to provide for myself, that, you know, I felt like they sort of had this gift through baseball that I really needed to honor. And, you know, and this was kind of my one, you know, obvious chance to like make a good life for my family. And, you know, that's not a necessarily a unique pressure, you know, like other athletes sort of feel that, but it was so clearly connected and just kind of been the through line all the way up for the past, you know, whatever, 20 years. And so just getting into, okay, well, like, tell me about, you know, your childhood, or why did you feel that sort of anxiety? You know, what were the financial pressures you dealt with and things like that? And so, using, and I'm also interested too in like, what does it feel like to live within that sort of world for so long? And one thing he said to me, like, this might've been like the first question I actually asked him when we sat down, something to the effect of, you know, did you have a season that you enjoyed the most, or is there a year you think about? And he said something to the effect of like the 4 days in between pitching he loved. It was the actual fifth day that he really had trouble with. And that feels like kind of counter to what a lot of athletes say. Like, they love the competing, they hate the work that goes into it, you know, they love the chance to just go out there. And he was like, oh no, that's just, I, you know, it's painful, it's, I feel pressure, like, it's really. And I just found that to be fascinating, because that's just not an answer you often hear from guys, especially at this stage, in the latter stage of their career.
Men will literally chase a World Series ring for 11 years instead of going to therapy, is kind of like the
but the thesis
of the book. Wait, one second, Drew. I want to touch on something that Andy said. So, like, one of the moments that really stood out to me was kind of early on in the book when you're talking about Kershaw's senior year of high school. Mm-hmm. And you know, so he basically grows up. I mean, his dad is someone in the picture early on, but he's really at that point in his life being raised by his mom in this like affluent community outside of Dallas. And the financial pressure of essentially having a single mom is kind of dawning on him. His mom has a lot of debts. And the moment of Kershaw kind of realizing, like, I need to perform in order to provide for my family. And that being a pressure, and you write, the weight would stay there for the entirety of his professional life. That made me think about Bryce Harper. Because Bryce Harper...
Because he plays for the Phillies?
Yeah. And I run their tweets. So, you know, Bryce Harper... has said like that he doesn't feel October pressure, because the pressure of being a 15-year-old on the cover of Sports Illustrated was greater than anything he has felt since. Kershaw has a different dynamic, right? Where it's like that was the origin of the pressure and has never stopped since. And I'm curious, like, why do you think those two dynamics are so different?
Well, I guess they're because they're different people is the simplest way of explaining it. I haven't talked to Harper too in depth about that, but I think that, you know, that external pressure, you know, the circumstances of his childhood, I think he probably has internalized and has kind of created this combustion engine inside him in which, you know, at this point, right, it's like a flywheel. It's just sort of going. You know, and so it starts external, but it becomes internal. And, you know, Harper, you know, maybe is, I don't want to, you know, describe anyone as better adjusted than anyone else, but it just sounds like a more, you know, but with Kershaw, right, the way he describes it is like there's always sort of another mountain to climb, right? Like you get drafted and like you get a big chunk of money, but that doesn't like solve everything, right? Because that money will go away. You know, you reach the majors. Okay, you need to get to arbitration. It's like, oh, you get to arbitration. Okay, like, well, now, you know, you're basically financially set. And then it's like, well, I would actually like to win something, you know? And he had reached a point where he was considered basically the best in the sport. And then the team got good, and then it becomes this just annual quest of like, can they win a World Series? And he is the central figure in that. And so the motivation or whatever it is that is actually driving you, the words for a change, but the actions, the sort of, you know, the core of it doesn't, if that makes sense.
You know, there's so many moments throughout Kershaw's career you can zoom in on because of how relevant he's been late into the season, because of the team that he's pitched for and because of how good he's been. But I want to kind of go back to, you know, those 4 days in between and Clayton Kershaw, the person, because you decide you want to write this book about Clayton Kershaw because you've been around him at the ballpark a lot and you've watched him compete in these big games. And I imagine once you very apparently quickly realize, oh yeah, no, I'm going to write a book about Clayton Kershaw, and he just agreed to it in 5 minutes, that starts to dawn. You're like, wow, there's going to be a lot else that I'm going to want to and have to uncover and understand about Clayton Kershaw, the person. So as you were kind of going through that process, like, did any of that change the way you thought about him, or did it really fortify what you had seemingly already understood about him, having watched him strictly on the field?
That's a good question. I don't know if anything, I don't know if there was too much that was changed. I think that there was a lot of stuff that was enhanced, if this makes sense. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. No, there wasn't a ton that I felt like, there was a lot of things that like, oh, I didn't know that, for example, but there wasn't much in the character aspect, because like I started reporting this book in earnest in, you know, in May of 2022, but like in actuality, I'd been, you know, talking to people and talking to him since 2016. So it's a, you know, almost a 10-year process of like doing long in-depth, you know, stories and, you know, having these conversations with people over the years. But so, I mean, I think what came through is like, you know, he is this sort of maniacal figure on the fifth day. And in between, he's like kind of a normal person. Like he's, you know, he's a bit of a dork. Like he likes The Office. He doesn't curse. You
he's,
know?
Dude, like, the part in the book where instead of, he says jack butt.
Yeah, that's a classic AJ Ellis anecdote. Yeah, yeah.
They were
talking about movies when they were in the minors, and Kershaw said his favorite movie was Jackbutt, and Ellis was like, "What are you talking about?" Yeah, because he didn't want to say Jackass. Yeah,
Jackbutt, I mean, though?
Jackbutt. I mean, just the Jackbutt franchise.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're on the same page, because some people feel very strongly about, you know, some of Jackbutt kind of tailing off, you know, later on in the franchise.
Right. And we didn't get too deep into like, do you like the CKY, you know, diaspora, like how much, you know, it's a real complicated topic. You know, I don't want to get political.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, so, you know, he's like he has the same friends, you know, that he did in high school. He likes playing ping pong. Like he's, you know, he likes dressing up in goofy costumes at his charity events. You know, he's like, he spends most of his time when he's not thinking about baseball, thinking about his children. You know, he's like a pretty normal person. And so I always found it was fascinating. It's like, dude, you're like this and then you're like that. How do you get to that? And it's just, you have to kind of burrow in and go back to, you know, childhood and things like that.
I want to talk about all the playoff stuff now. When you read the book over, it is really a jarring reminder of how many times Clayton Kershaw was forced to shoulder this load in October. And there are all these games you like forget about because there's so many of them, right? Like I had totally forgotten about that the Cardinals thing happened twice, that there were 2 years where the Cardinals, you know, that had run together in my mind. And then like, 2017 feels like the bottom, and then like 2019 against the Nationals is somehow even lower, because he's put in a position not to succeed. When you were kind of picking through each of these individual failures, was it difficult to go to him and try and distinguish one from another, to be like, all right, we just sat down and talked through 16.
Yeah.
Right, let's do 17.
Well, there's some where I just didn't feel like they were worth, like 16 is not worth really an in-depth exploration from a emotional, or from like a, I don't
know 18 too. Right word.
Yeah, because 18 is just like his body didn't work. Like he wasn't, like as I remember, you know, someone with the organization was like, this isn't a Kershaw in the playoffs problem in 2018. This is just a Kershaw problem. Like his body wasn't functioning right. He was like, you know, couldn't differentiate between the fastball and the slider. And in 16, it was just like, yeah. So I came back from a major back injury, probably earlier than I should. There was a significant chance I needed surgery. And then I pitched 4 times in like a 10-day span, you know, in leading up to game 6. And then I got, you know, gave up 5 runs in 5 innings to a good team. Oh, what a collapse. You know, it's like, so there really are, for me, it's like there's the, you know, there's the Cardinals stuff, right? Like that felt like worth like, hey, let's try and get into this. And even that, with the Cardinal stuff, you can, you know, like AJ Ellis thinks a lot about those games a lot more than Kershaw does, I think, right? Because to Ellis, whose career, you know, ended earlier, and who is sort of, you know, he like can perseverate on those sort of games in the way that Kershaw is still moving forward. So you can go to other people.
Ned Coletti, I'm sure.
Ned Coletti, you know, there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of people involved in those 13 and 14 games who, you know, had theories. I mean, there's like the pitch tipping stuff that the Cardinals just outright, you know, sort of deny. And the Dodgers people are like, well, they're lying. And it's like, okay, I don't know why this is, you know, it's pitch tipping. Like, he either was or he wasn't. But anyway, there was a good, yeah, Mark McGwire said something to me when he was like, well, Kershaw tipped his curveball every time. And I like, didn't know how to. And I was like, he did? He goes, yeah, I could see it from the dugout. And I was like, hey, is that a thing that everyone can see? Or can you just see that because you're Mark McGwire? So that was a fun. That was one of my favorite questions I asked during this reporting process. But to me, like the, you know, so you can work around 13 and 14 and 17 and 19 were the two that I felt like I needed to talk to him the most about, where I really needed his insight, you know, specifically like, why didn't you, you know, change your sequences more often against the Astros, you know, put me in your headspace when you're being told, hey, they're stealing signs. And you're like, I don't understand how they can get them. And then in 2019, it's like, what the heck happened there? Like, how did you get sent back out, you know, for a second inning? And so, yeah, I mean, it's,
and there's still like there, I read that this morning. There's still no consensus there. Like Dave Roberts still has a different memory of those events than Kershaw does, than other people do. And like,
yeah, they're still sort of like, you know, there's not a unified theory of what exactly happened there. And understandably, it's not something people really want to talk about all that much, you know, cause it's a, I mean, that's, you know, that game five in 2019. I mean, that's like, you know, Dylan Hernandez described it as breathtaking, and not in a good way, but in literally sitting in the press box, it took your breath away watching it. It was, as someone who has no rooting interest whatsoever, it was just, I very rarely am I at a baseball game where it's like, wow, this is hard to watch. And that was for me, yeah, I mean, the most sort of, you know, yeah, breathtaking.
Which is saying something, because we'd already watched it happen to him so many times. But even watching him, maybe I'm overrating like his literal reaction and what his body language.
Well, I think some of it too was afterwards, where he just appeared, you know, where he said, everything they say about me in the postseason is true. I mean, you just like, and going around the room, you know, like, you know, Rich Hill started crying talking about, you know, him, like, choked up. And I had this in the book, and this is part of one of the reasons, you know, earlier in the, before I started the process, when I really thought there might be something there, was Daniel Hudson told me this story. Hudson played on the Nationals in 2019, and he had been on the Dodgers the year before. And so I talked to him in 2020 for a story I was writing on Kershaw, and I asked him just like, hey, like, as someone who played with him, like, how did you feel about how that whole thing played out? Like, did you feel bad for him at all? And he was like, oh my God, like, I was heartbroken, you know? And he was telling me the story of like, the Nationals celebrate, you know, they tear apart the visitors clubhouse, spray champagne, and they're on the bus back to Pasadena. And he's like on his phone, just kind of scrolling through, and he starts watching Kershaw's interview where he's like, you know, everything they say about me in the postseason is true. And Daniel Hudson like almost starts breaking down, you know, getting choked up for a guy he played with for one season, you know? And that was part of where I was like, okay, this guy has meant a lot to a lot of different people who he hasn't even played with all that, you know, that's where I felt like there was more worth exploring. So, anyway, it's a long way around answering your question. I felt like 17 and 19 were the two where his insight was the most crucial.
Hmm. Well, and also it's just wild to think, you know, you said you started covering the Dodgers in 2016, correct? Yeah. At that point, not that you weren't familiar with, you know, what had happened before then, but there was already, you know, a catalog in these moments that you come in at that point, and then to get that many more before we get to 2020 is staggering. I mean, I'm just, you know, pulling this up now. After that Nationals, you know, game, he was at 158 career playoff innings, you know, 25 starts with a 4.43 ERA and a 6.64 OPS allowed. Like, the numbers were still pretty good, but boy, were they not sequenced in the ways.
Yeah, so much of it is sequencing. And like, look, the book is not meant to, you know, defend his postseason performance or anything like that, or to, you know, to make excuses. It's,
I actually think you do the opposite. Like, especially when it comes to 17, like his stubbornness, in some ways, right? Baseball is random and stupid, and like no one thing changes any one thing. But like, it is clear to me that to a certain extent, there was enough paranoia and a valid paranoia around the Dodgers, where Alex Wood was changing his signs in Kershaw because he's Kershaw and was so wedded to his process, like, didn't want to do that. And that had an immeasurable impact.
Yes, it did. I will say that, you know, and there's only so much you can get into a book, but like, I don't think Wood would object to this. Wood is more of a paranoid person than Kershaw is. You know, there are some players who are more conspiracy minded. Chase Utley, for example. Chase Utley would see a light flash in the stands and be like, they're stealing our signs from out there. We need to go get out there, you know, and they'd be like, shut up. You know, they treated him like, you know, he was like a JFK sort of, you know, freak. Like, dude, chill out. Like, stop watching the Zapruder film after every game. But, you know, so there are certain, and Kershaw is not one of those players. He's not one of those guys who thinks a lot, you know, like I remember during that World Series when Justin Verlander was complaining about the baseballs, Kershaw was asked about it. He's like, are the balls the same for both teams? Like, yes. And he was like, I don't care, you know, and that's, and like, look, you can, you know, the ball, like, it's not to judge it either way, but it's like, he tends to, you know, his argument was, you can't prove to me that this is happening. Why would I change what I'm doing in the biggest games of my life, you know, on sort of a whim?
And totally reasonable.
Yeah. And I think that that's part of what makes it so painful for everyone involved, is that it's like a failure of imagination, you know, and they couldn't. And I also thought it was interesting, you know, and like talking to other pitchers in that series, you know, like Brandon McCarthy, like Tony Watson, guys who did change their signs. And it was like, how did you feel about that? And Watson was like, yeah, I had this one set of signs where I had my mouth open and then one where it was closed. And then I'm out there at Minute Maid and it's like the loudest building ever. And I got my mouth hanging open. I'm like, I just feel like an idiot, you know? And McCarthy was like, yeah, I changed my signs and I thought it was dumb. Like, I thought we were wasting our time doing it. It's, that is the one where, like, I do think his stubbornness played a part in it, but his argument, as you said, is pretty reasonable.
I want to bring this, you know, forward now, you know, closer to the present day, because that's the other fascinating element of just the timing of all this, right? I mean, there are many biographies that I imagine are starting to be written as soon as a player announces his retirement or, you know, plays his last game and then you get to work. This is, of course, not the case for Clayton Kershaw in many fascinating respects. And what has happened to him on and off the field over the last 2 years has, I imagine, added a lot to the story. Did that make it more challenging or did it make it more compelling? I have to imagine that was one of the most difficult parts about this. And then ultimately now, for those who haven't followed his story that closely, where are we at right now with Clayton Kershaw and what are we, you know, expecting moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, his hope is to be back in, you know, July or August. He's coming off, you know, major shoulder surgery. You know, it's a big procedure, you know, getting your capsule repaired. He had never undergone a surgery before in his career. And so he's in a bit of uncharted territory with regard to that. But the hope, you know, his hope is that he'll be back by the summer. And I guess we'll see. It feels dumb betting against him, but also, you know, he's 36 and coming off major shoulder surgery. So like we shall see. And yeah, I think that, you know, the sort of model I had for this book is Ian O'Connor wrote something about Derek Jeter that came out, I want to say in like 2011 or so, but that he had started working on, you know, during the course of 2010. And what is, you know, it was the idea of like the definitive work of your time as a Yankee. And that's kind of how I proposed to Kershaw. I was like, the definitive, you know, story of your time as a Dodger. And similar to Jeter, like that last year was, you know, got more interesting, I think, than expected. And, you know, both from a health perspective, both from, you know, his contractual status. And what was really interesting for me is, you know, just some of the stuff in the last chapter of getting to spend time with him and talk to him, you know, in a way that it seemed like he was a bit more candid just about some of the physical challenges he was dealing with last year, some of the, you know, just a mental and emotional challenges that he had, you know, being apart from his family, some of, you know, kind of crises of faith he was dealing with and, things like that. And so it felt like a more immersive, look that like that last chapter ended up being a lot more, it wasn't just kind of like, you know, putting a bow on things. There was a lot more action than I expected, I guess. And so I think it makes the work more compelling, and I think it rounds out the portrait of him in a way that I'm happy with. But I you know, you just never know what is going to happen when you start working on a project like this. And so it went in some directions I didn't expect.
Well, that's, I think, a really compelling element of the book, is that it's living and breathing. Like, it is relevant now. You know, it is these characters, many of them are still the characters. There's a chance that Dave Roberts will need to, you know, manage Clayton Kershaw in a postseason game in a handful of months from now, right? And this book gives you a very clear understanding of their relationship and that dynamic. And so because of that, I'm just curious, like, how hard was it to report out things that happened versus things that are happening?
I mean, I think that most of my, yeah, I mean, I guess you just kind of have to do it concurrently. Like, I sort of looked at it as like, I needed to get the stuff that happened first, and then as much stuff that was happening as I could get would be useful. And it ended up, you know, I was able to, yeah, I mean, I finished this book in February. You know, that was when we're doing the final interviews for it. And that's normally not how it works with a book. So I was having conversations with, you know, people on the Dodgers, Kershaw himself, you know, up until, yeah, I mean, like 4 months ago. I mean, I was having conversations with him over text, you know, when I was on my honeymoon in Vietnam about stuff, which, you know, my wife was not too thrilled about. but yeah, so like, it's, you know, this is the only book I've ever written, so I don't know how the process is supposed to go. And it felt similar to, you know, you're doing a big story and you kind of scramble at the end to get a lot of stuff tied up. And so there were some challenges of getting people to agree to talk, but for the most part, I was able to get everyone who I wanted. And was
my favorite characters who don't talk are the basically the scouting department of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yeah.
You don't have to dive into this, but like, it is very clear from reading the book that the front office of the Kansas City Royals at the time, who had the first pick, who passed on Kershaw, they do not lose sleep over that decision.
Yeah.
Whereas the people who are running like the Pirates, who were like close to thinking about taking Kershaw, are still uncomfortable to this day with that decision. Like, reading that section made me laugh a little bit.
Yeah, I offered,
like, the draft is hard. The draft is really hard.
Is very hard, and taking a left-handed, you know, high school kid pitcher is somewhat insane, which I tried to get across in the book of like, here's why six teams passed, and it pretty much all makes sense, right? Yeah, but there was, you know, so talking to Derek Ladner, the scouting director for the Royals at the time, who subsequently, you know, gone on to fame and fortune with a variety of other clubs. I believe he's the scouting director for the Astros now, right? He just left the D-backs. But, you know, Derek Ladner is like, he drafted Zach Greinke and he drafted Corbin Carroll. He's very good at this. He's confident in his ability. And he was able to explain, like, look, we looked at Kershaw for 1-1. Here's why we took Luke Hochaver. You know, Bob Fontaine Jr. was like, we loved Kershaw. Here's why we took, you know, Brandon Morrow. RJ Harrison of the Rays is like, I have never lost a single second of sleep taking Evan Longoria over Kershaw. It was the best pick I ever made, you know? And like, I appreciated
that. The Rockies
that.
Were like, who's Clayton Kershaw?
Yeah. Yeah. Bill Schmidt, said, well, you know, Brandon Belt, anyway, we don't need to get into Bill Schmidt. The Rockies are what they are. But the Pirates were, you know, I reached out to, you know, Dave Littlefield, the GM. I reached out to the scouting director. I reached out to, you know, the area scout. None of them were interested in talking. And so that's, you know, it is what it is. I was able to connect with some people who had worked for the Pirates at that time, who explained why it was an ownership decision, not really a scouting department decision. But I can understand why folks would not want to revisit something like that. I remember one time I was doing a podcast with John Daniels, and I was like, hey, John, can you tell me about the time you traded Adam Eaton for Adrian Gonzalez from Adam Eaton? And he was like, hey, thanks for having me on your show to talk about the dumbest thing I ever did. I really appreciate it, man. I'm glad I came on. So I can understand.
Jordan, I remember, do you remember we were in college and we somehow had Fred Clare on our podcast?
Yes.
I don't know how he pulled that off. And Fred Clare referred to the Pedro Martinez trade as a disastrous car crash.
Yeah. He was like, it was watching that unfold over the, you know, following years was just like, no.
And we didn't even ask. Just brought it up. He's
just like, hey, you want to know something dumb I did once?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, we know it's on this transaction log. It was a pretty big deal.
It's a bummer.
The one thing that we haven't talked about yet, by the way, is he wins. Clayton Kershaw, spoilers. Yeah. He does win in 2020. And there is a narrative that some people believe that the 2020 postseason and World Series somehow, it is different, right? It's unavoidable that it was a different experience. But there are some people who view that as less, that it was somehow like a fakeness, a lack of authenticity to that ring. How does Kershaw feel about that? Does he see his work as complete? Does he see the goal as accomplished? Or are we going to reach a point where if he wins another one, he's like, now I have a real one?
Yeah.
Is there any of that dynamic at play?
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic for sure. I think when they won, it was very much like, this World Series is real. We won the World Series. No one can ever take this away from us. You know, he played We Are the Champions at his house for weeks on end. You know, he was like, he would just like look in the mirror and be like, we won the World Series. You know, he was just, it was so like, and my stance on it, I mean, just my brief opinion is that if they were going to play that stupid season, you might as well count it. Otherwise, what are we doing? Right. Okay. However, I do think, and this is more for the Dodgers writ large than it is for Kershaw per se, because I do think he feels that the validation and the understanding of like, yes, we did win. I do think he would very much like another one. I think he would be okay without another one. But, you know, for the organization, I feel like in the subsequent years, they have downplayed the significance of that title almost as an involuntary reaction to how frustrating the past three postseasons have gone. That they, especially in 21 and 22, created this super team that crashed out of the postseason without even making the World Series. I mean, for example, like they don't have a banner at Camelback Ranch about the 2020 World Series. They don't have signage. They don't have a statue. They don't have anything that says, hey, by the way, we won the World Series in 2020. It was like, which, something
that
they were.
If you go to any other team stadium, they will, like, you go to any Washington Nationals facility, they are pulverizing you with the reality of their.
You go to the. I was in Surprise Stadium where the Rangers play, and it's, you know, the everywhere. Rangers have stuff everywhere. The Royals still have stuff everywhere from 2015. The Dodgers have no signage, and they were like, I was asking around about it this spring. I was doing something related to Ohtani, and they were kind of, you know, the explanation was given was like, oh yeah, we were gonna do something, and then we had like construction delays from the pandemic, and they're like, just like, ah, whatever.
Sure, and, dude.
Well, I think that, you know, it's sort of like how they're, you know, just as time passes, they get more frustrated with the misses. And that one thing that surprised me, I think, you know, actually to get back to one of Jordan's earlier questions is, I was under the impression that the losses that hurt Kershaw the most were the early ones, like 13, 14, you know, whatever. 17 is like an outlier. 17 is the one that clearly hurts the most. But I was under the impression that like the Cardinal stuff was really painful for him. And he was kind of like, yeah, it sucked, but I knew we would get back. And he's like, but like losing to the Padres in 2022, it's like they were a 110 win team. Internally, their projection system suggested they were actually like a 120 win team. Like they might've been, they felt like internally, this is the actual best baseball team ever assembled. And they lost in four games to the Padres, right? The year before, they have this 107 win or 106 win juggernaut that like loses the division to the Giants and, you know, kind of just runs out of gas against the 88 win Braves. And I think that there is an internal frustration about that. And I think the way Kershaw framed it is like those losses are, they're more painful because he understands that time is running out, I guess. And there's not going to be that many more chances for him specifically.
Time is running out and the Dodgers keep getting better. which seems absurd considering what you saw, you know, 10 years ago. Well, whatever. They keep adding talent to a degree that results in projection systems expecting them to have the greatest this ever.
They're going to win 100 games, Jake. Like, they're
I understand.
Not getting better, but they are not getting worse. They are sustainable in a way that seemed impossible.
Yeah. The 2024 Dodgers are a good ball club. Yeah.
Yes. And are they as good as the 17 Dodgers? Are they as good as the 19 Dodgers? Are they as good as the 20 Dodgers, 22? I don't know. They're going to be really good, and they're going to be in the postseason. Right. It would help if their best players got hits when the postseason started.
Yo, good getting enough. Hits, that would be so... That's a
huge... Hey, one thing the Cardinals
did... Why didn't they do that last year?
They got some hits.
That was weird. Last year, they did not. There were not a lot of hits happening last year.
There's very few. I covered all of them.
Yeah.
Let me wrap this up. Andy, what was your favorite part to report out? Like, what, when you look back on the experience of writing the book?
Yeah.
I mean, you talked to 215 people.
I did.
It's like a
one
lot
of them
of
was Dylan Hernandez. People. Yeah.
But you do that all the time.
I had a really, I feel like my experience is maybe a little bit different than how other people have described writing books. I really enjoyed this. Like, I really liked it, and I really want to do it again. And, yeah, I got to figure that out. But anyway, I really enjoyed the process. I will say the chapter that probably means the most to me, in just because it was early in the process, and it was very foundational to my belief that I could actually do this. And this is, you know, we're getting a little inside baseball, to use a phrase, fellas. The chapter about the Team USA summer, where they, you know, basically, you know, Kershaw played in the Pan Am games. That was kind of I wrote the first chapter, and then I knew I had to keep reporting for the second and third, but this was the fourth chapter of the book. And it's the one that, really got me rolling into the process of doing it. And so I really enjoyed trying to contextualize, you know, Clayton Kershaw as a, you know, 16, 17 year old prospect heading into his senior season, and showing where he stacked up against a variety of other players. I always find that really fascinating when you can do that with, you know, like there's a David Halberstam's book about Michael Jordan. He sort of talks about how, like, Jordan's camps heading into UNC, he was considered like the number four or five freshman, you know, like on, you know, of their recruits. And it's like, well, okay, how is that possible? Right. And so then I really enjoyed kind of getting a chance to talk to some of these guys who had made it, some of these guys who had never made it. You know, like everyone from, you know, like Tyson Ross to, you know, Lars Anderson, you know, to
dude Staten, you know,
these
Thomas.
Guys like, oh, that was a fun one. Yeah, that was a little different, but yes, Staten Thomas is is the gentleman who he ended up actually playing in the Rays system for a little while, but he hit the home run that may have caused the Pirates not to draft Kershaw. I told him, and like, I don't, that story is like kind of apocryphal, like, because I think that the Pirates weren't going to draft him either way, but Dodgers people believe that this is why the Pirates didn't take him. And so I was talking to Staten Thomas, and he thought he was getting away with it, but he had me on speakerphone, and a buddy was listening in. And because I think he was like, I think he was just so taken aback. He's like, I'm doing an interview about Clayton Kershaw, which was cool. But he was like, I was explaining to him, I was like, yeah, you know, like, you hit the homer that cost him, he would have gone fourth in the draft. And he was like, what? And I was like, yeah, you cost him millions of dollars. And he was like, please tell him I'm sorry, but thank you, Dodgers fans. You're welcome, you know? So like, that was fun. But anyway, yeah, that Team USA chapter was very important to me, and I really enjoyed doing it. And it was something that, as we were sanding the book down and editing, people were like, you could cut the Team USA chapter. I'm like, no, we're keeping all of it. Like, I'm not changing a word about Jerry Dawson, the, you know, the Marshall Bearing guy who was the head coach. And I'm, leaving in the stuff about Dellin Betances' sideways hat and stuff like that. It was, you know, so that one was really fun for me.
That is, yes, that definitely, in terms of contextualizing, that's something I've certainly, if people who've listened to me talk about baseball, is contextualizing players at the amateur stage is never not fascinating.
Kershaw, going into Kershaw's senior season, right? He's like a top 35 high school prospect, right? He was the number three starter on his travel ball team. Like, he was behind Jordan Walden and Sean Tolleson. And he was number three. The number four starter was Zach Britton, by the way. Oh. It was a good club.
You imagine?
Yeah, that's a problem. It's a bad day. It's a bad day to be a hitter.
That's That's a tough weekend if you draw a D-bat in 2005.
And then you got to go do your homework.
Kershaw adopted jumping off the mound like Jordan Walden.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, and that's part of it is like Logan White went to see Jordan Walden and he was like, this guy jumps off the mound. We can't, this won't work.
If you don't know, if you don't know what you're talking, if we're talking about, just go look it up. All right. Yeah. We need to.
No,
we need
I want to talk about the 05 draft. What else do you guys got to talk about? Oh, the White Sox aren't good.
No.
Are the Astros in trouble?
Andy, as Jake said earlier, it is very cool that this is a living, breathing book right now. And while I am obviously not thrilled that Clayton Kershaw had to have this serious surgery, the timing here with him in this lull and this book coming out as we are all just like waiting for him to come back is pretty amazing. And I hope that people go buy and read it and tell people where they can do that. And then we'll say goodbye.
Yeah, sure. You should buy it wherever you like buying books. You know, if you want to support like your local independents, like that's always cool. You know, bookshop.org does great work with that. But, you know, Barnes and Noble, Amazon, however you like buying books. I mean, I think, I hate this aspect of it, but like, if you're going to buy it, pre-order it, that's good because that'll get it out more in the world and more people can see it. But I'm just thrilled that people are interested and, you know, giving it a chance because it's, I'm really proud of the work and I really enjoyed doing it and I want to get a chance to do it again. So, if you buy enough of these, if you hate my power rankings for The Athletic, if you hate the blurbs that I'm writing, buy as many copies so that I can quit the business and just become an author.
I'm like, I'll fire some people up.
Love that. It is a phenomenal work and I
thank you.
You can feel that you enjoyed it when you read it and the thoroughness of it all is just phenomenal. And as someone who was lucky enough to watch the very minor parts of you reporting this out at the end, we would play a game where we would walk into a clubhouse.
Yeah, that was fun.
And I would try and determine which players on the team Andy was there to talk to about Clayton Kershaw. So I would like look around the room and be like, Blue Jays. Well, Brandon Belt is from Texas.
Yeah, that's right.
And they were the same age as Brandon Belt.
Yeah, left-handed but pitcher, it is Brandon Belt. Yep.
Brandon Belt, who you describe as the Texas high school pitcher, Brandon Belt.
That was my editor was like, do you want to put in that he became the first baseman for the Giants? I'm like, nah, we'll get to that later. Just call him a left-handed pitcher. No. Come on.
People figure it out. They'll put two.
You do the same thing. You do the same thing with Paul Goldschmidt where you call him third baseman for the Woodlands, right?
I do want to share. Sorry. I just like talking about this and you guys might appreciate this. So Paul Goldschmidt played third baseman for the Woodlands, and there was a game where Sean Tolleson, a huge prospect and heading into 06, and Kyle Drabek, another huge prospect in 06, played each other very early in the season. And Sean Tolleson, during that game, blew out his elbow, but he didn't know he blew out. He just knew he hurt his elbow, and he didn't want to hurt his draft stock, so he faked an ankle injury and limped off the mound. And Goldschmidt was there. And I remember I was talking to Paul for the book and he mentioned something about seeing Tolleson in high school. And I'd like hadn't thought about this and it clicked. And I was like, oh, you were at the game where he blew out. And he was like, why do you know about this? And I was just like,
best feeling.
Yeah. I was like, he was like, yeah, that's a very odd memory. And I'm like, yeah, anyway. So that was fun. All right,
We have that experience like 10 times a week, so it is.
I would say, like Jake, that's your life all the time talking to players. Where they're just like, "Why are you aware of that?" And you're like, "I don't have other interests."
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'm like a slightly more adjusted version of Narjuar is kind of how I think about it. Andy, thank you for coming on. I will say, like, being around you, Andy, for the last 2 years and watching you work, I have learned an immeasurable amount about this business. And I do believe that you are the best baseball writer we have right now. And so I cannot encourage people enough to go buy this book so that Andy can write more of them. Please.
Look at Jordan shaking his head.
I haven't spent enough time with Andy. I can't validate any of this. But thanks for coming on the pod, man. This was fun.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. So much to talk about, and we're going to talk about none of it right now. The one thing that I think we should just bring up, Mike Trout is going to get knee surgery and be out for a while. Not all year. He was super emotional discussing the news yesterday on Tuesday. We'll dive into that and just another time, another bummer for Trout missing an extended period, but felt like we needed to at least bring that up at the end of this pod. Jordan, thank you for doing another podcast with me. Thank you to Andy McCullough for coming on and talking about Clayton Kershaw and the process of writing a book. It made reading this book made me both really want to write a book and made me feel like I could never write a book better than this. And so there's no point in ever writing a book at the same time. It's how I like feel when I read anything from Emma Baccalieri. I'm like, well, I don't need to write ever again.
Well, we will deal with that internal struggle off the air. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. And we'll be back on Friday getting to all of the news and on-field action that we did not get to today. But we hope you enjoyed this episode. And we will talk to you soon.
Yes, we will talk about the B guy. We promise.